I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We start today with a table setter for the week ahead in Washington, although we're not sure silverware is a good idea. This weekend, political alliances fell apart. Lawmakers accused each other of posturing. Arizona's governor signed into law a tough immigration bill that pushed immigration reform to the top of the Obama agenda, elbowing aside climate change. Today, Republicans are threatening to filibuster a key test vote on financial reform, even as Democrats push to regulate the financial instruments that caused the collapse. And President Obama joined Republicans in putting the focus on the November midterm elections.
Today, the health insurance companies, the Wall Street banks, and the special interests who have ruled Washington for too long are already focused on November's congressional elections. They see these elections as a chance to put their allies back in power and to undo all that we've accomplished. So this year, I need your help once more.
That's President Obama addressing his supporters in a YouTube clip that was released today. Well, Michael Shear is White House correspondent for Time magazine. He joins us from Washington. And Michael, we're feeling as if there's been sort of this whip around over the weekend. What's the feeling in Washington?
Well, we're 6 months away, a little more than 6 months away from the midterm elections, but it's clear that election season is already sort of taking over. It's not that politics hasn't already been dominating policy here in Washington. It's just that now it's more like that than it was before in all areas.
Well, you know, and we are hearing people say, for instance, Republicans accusing the Obama administration of just seizing on immigration reform because they see the anger of Hispanics in Arizona and they're trying to make that a political issue. Couldn't it be said that they really are concerned that there may be more state laws passed, like the strict Arizona law that requires police to ask people for their identification?
I have no doubt that they're concerned. The question is, if you put truth serum drip into Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, do they really want to vote to pass a bill this year? And I think the answer is probably no. Harry Reid wants this issue. He's in a very tough reelect fight in Nevada with a large Hispanic voting population. And Democrats generally want this issue to drum up support from their base. But if they get a bill passed this year, especially in the House, it could become very damaging for a number of sort of purple state, purple district members for whom Democrats for whom right. immigration is a loser issue in election year, not a winning issue.
Well, in fact, Republican Lindsey Graham walked away from the bipartisan climate change bill because he was angry that immigration reform had leapfrogged over that bill. And your colleague at Time, Joe Klein, characterizes this, though, as a big favor to Democrats. He says, you know, he's actually handed them this gift because if there isn't climate change and if there isn't even immigration reform because of the time, there's not enough time, that may be good for Democrats because people are angry about government activism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. I didn't think a couple weeks ago that there was much hope for either immigration reform or a climate change bill this year unless you really watered it down and made it more of a spending bill to just increase funding for various types of energy production. So I don't know if it's that big of a change. I think Joe's right in that these issues are maybe more potent than they are than bills passing for the Democrats, and that was the point I was making before. Yeah. I don't think Democrats want immigration passed this year as much as they want the issue. And you have a similar thing going on right now, at least in the short term, with financial regulation.
Well, let's talk about financial regulations. There's expected to be a test vote on even debating it this afternoon. Republicans are saying that they're going to hold that up. Where are, you know, both sides of the aisle squaring off this Monday?
Well, the good news is that financial regulation reform is much closer to actually happening than most people thought it would be a couple months ago. The bad news is that there's still a lot of short-term politics to be played here. Essentially, Democrats have controlled the negotiations in the Senate, and it's an issue of how far they want to go to compromise with Republicans and whether they just want to try and peel off one or two Republicans or try and bring in 10 or 15 Republicans onto the bill. What's happened is over the weekend, the Democrats did not compromise much, and so they're again gaining the issue and losing the vote probably. I mean, there could be a last-minute deal struck here, but it looks like Republicans will filibuster or deny cloture on a motion to open the debate on the financial regulatory bill now, which will send everyone back to the table and will allow for several more days of Democrats saying that Republicans are siding with Wall Street banks and Republicans saying that Democrats are you know, in favor of bailouts or big government plans.
Meanwhile, also on the schedule, just have to mention tomorrow, Goldman Sachs is on the Hill. A lot of grilling there, and that'll also play into that debate. That's Michael Shear, White House correspondent for Time magazine. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, now a topic that might be tender for some families if you have kids in the car. On Friday, a jury in Portland, Oregon, awarded a former Boy Scout $18.5 million on top of the $1.5 million previously awarded to Kerry Lewis in an abuse lawsuit he brought against the Boy Scouts of America. Kerry Lewis made the case that in the early 80s, the Boy Scouts knew that his scoutmaster, Timur Dykes, had molested him and other children because Dykes had actually confessed this to a Mormon leader. The Mormon Church sponsored Lewis's scout troop and sponsors many others. But Timur Dykes was allowed to continue leading scouting activities until he was eventually sent to prison, convicted of other child abuse charges. Kerry Lewis claimed the scouts not only failed to set up a system to prevent and report abuse, but also kept hundreds of files on scoutmasters accused of abuse and didn't do anything with those files. In a moment, a scoutmaster who's trying to change the culture from within. But first, Patrick Boyle. He's editor of the newspaper Youth Today, author of the book Scouts Honor, which is all about sex abuse in the Boy Scouts. And Patrick, right away, that had us thinking, a whole book on sex abuse in the Scouts. Is there that much?
There's an awful lot, and not only has there been a lot, but it's been that way pretty much since the beginning, which is what I try to explain in the book, because unfortunately, while Scouting is a wonderful organization, one of the most well-regarded youth organizations in the world, it also is inadvertently a perfect place for child molesters, and they've known this for a long time. I wrote the book based on about almost 1,900 files about men who had been kicked out of scouting for abuse.
Well, the Scouts were founded in 1910. Those files were first revealed in 1935 when the first chief scout executive revealed that the Boy Scouts kept what's called a red flag list of leaders who'd been removed. What did you see in these files?
A confidential file contains a lot of information. It's not always the same information. They always contain some basic biographical information about the scout leader and a brief description of what he did. But in these files, as you open them up, you also find newspaper clippings that describe the case. You find police reports, letters from scout officials among each other describing the incidents, but also sometimes describing efforts to keep the cases quiet. You'll find letters written by molesters, sometimes to the kids, sometimes to scout officials, and sometimes letters written by the victims themselves describing what happened.
Well, one of the criticisms of the lawyers for former scout Kerry Lewis is that the scouts didn't do anything with this material. What did they say to that?
The Boy Scouts organization, I mean, and I do want to stress that this is, we're talking about the corporation here, not the people around the country who run scouting on the ground.
Right.
There is an enormous difference here between the scouting movement on the ground, the volunteers and the parents who work and the kids, and the Boy Scouts of America, Inc., which is a corporation that runs the scouting program. And Boy Scouts, Inc. basically said, we never noticed that we had a problem, that we had all these files coming in, but we had files coming in on other things too. You know, you can get kicked out of scouts for cursing in front of the kids or being drunk, that kind of thing. And nobody knew there was a problem in society in general, and we just kind of kept these files and didn't study them and moved along. Those of us who have read the files find that hard to believe, even taking into account retrospect and the benefit of hindsight. In many years, the vast majority of the cases coming to the Scouts where people are kicked out for any reason at all involves sex abuse of kids. In some cases, 70% of the files that they got about people being banned had to do with perversion and sex abuse. But they never looked at their own cases.
Have you seen the file on Timur Dykes?
Yes, I have.
And how is it, do we know, did he remain in scouting even after he confessed to a member of the Mormon Church that he had abused Kerry Lewis and 16 others? We understand it wasn't until a police officer made a routine traffic stop during a camping trip and found that Dykes had a record that he was arrested. And this was in front of several scouts, including
right.
Kerry Lewis.
Timur Dykes took advantage of a loophole in the Scouts confidential file system. And this loophole really involved training. The local leaders that confronted Dykes did not report the case up to national headquarters right away, which is what you're supposed to do. One of the problems back in, especially in the 70s and 80s, is you see these cases in the files where the system was not really that tight. And so the Scouts had a system, but the education for local leaders, including those who, for instance, worked at the churches that sponsored the troops, which is the case here, didn't always know what they were really supposed to do. And sometimes they followed the inclination they had to just keep things quiet. And that's what happened in this case. What's really striking here is that they let him continue working with the troop in what appears to be some sort of unofficial manner. That is not unheard of during this period in the 70s and 80s. The training was just not very good, and these local leaders sometimes just winged it.
Well, we're going to talk more about training today, but in the meantime, what did the Boy Scouts organization say in their defense during the Kerry Lewis trial? We understand that they tried to put the blame not only on Timur Dykes and the Mormon Church, but on parents.
Yeah, there was one scout official who took the stand and said that the parents were actually behaving almost criminally in letting their boys stay over Dyke's house or his apartment. He backtracked from that. It was an outrageous statement to make, and it shows sometimes where the problem, again, is between the scout officials and the local volunteers. The Boy Scouts of America has built its reputation for a century on being trustworthy as an organization, and it has told parents, you can trust us. And yet, in these files, if you study them, you will see that the second most popular place for sex abuse of scouts is at the home of the scout leader. Now, I know that because I analyzed the files. The scouts had all of these files, and if they had looked at their files, they would have put out word to parents, you can't let this go on.
Well, Patrick, the scouts say they now teach kids through videos and pamphlets about the danger of possibly being abused. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the scouts have some of the best material I've seen out there on sex abuse prevention, and including material to educate boys. In fact, quite frankly, I've used one of the scout videos with my own son, who's now 13. The issue for me as a parent is if I go to a scout troop with my son, I'm not sure what I'm going to get. I've talked to people recently about this, and the Boy Scouts urge local troops and units to show this material to the kids. The implementation sometimes depends on what goes on the local level.
We understand, too, that the materials may warn scouts about the stranger danger, about the danger of a female babysitter, which is very rare, but not about the danger of their own scout leader.
Right. When you read through the material, it's almost comical sometimes the way the organization dances around the issue of Boy Scout leaders in particular. One of the criticisms of the Scouts is, unlike the Catholic Church, which has been forced to basically confront its own problem head on and say, yes, we are responding because of our own problem, the BSA Incorporated has basically said, we're responding because abuse is a problem in society in general, not because of a problem in scouting.
Well, when you mention the Catholic Church, let's put this in perspective. How many lawsuits against the Boy Scouts of America alleging sexual abuse on the part of a scout master have there been?
The best I can tell you is that by the early 90s, we knew there had been about 60 lawsuits. And they wanted to keep it quiet, just like everybody else did. Look, schools did the same thing. Churches did it. Daycare centers did it. But when you're holding yourself out to be a trustworthy organization, you know, the people who ran scouting throughout the country really needed to depend on the people at the national level to behave in a completely responsible and forthright way, to kind of follow the scout law and be straight up about this, and they were not.
Patrick Boyle is author of Scout's Honor. We're going to have more with him and with a scout master who says the Girl Scouts have a better abuse prevention program than boys do. We'll find out why in 1 minute here and now. Welcome back. We're talking about the Boy Scouts of America. On Friday, they were ordered to pay a multi-million-dollar damage award to a former scout who was sexually abused as a child by a troop leader who'd confessed to abusing kids. The case revealed that the Boy Scouts of America kept secret files about that case and others. The scouts are appealing the jury award, and many have accused the scout who brought the suit of being an ambulance chaser. We've been talking with Patrick Boyle, author of Scout's Honor, a book about sex abuse in the scouts. We'll talk to him more in a second, but first we'd like to bring in a scout volunteer. Mike Carroll is a defense contractor in West Central Florida and a lifelong member of the Scouts. He's now a unit commissioner, which means he drops in on scout meetings in his area. He also used to train scout masters to identify and prevent abuse using videos developed by the Boy Scouts. And Mike, your thoughts on all of this?
If Patrick could write this book in 1994, and if I could come out of off active duty and become the district training chairman in my little piece of the west coast of Florida and start presenting this videotape to people, and we can still have this same thing in 2010 that comes around, then we need to have stronger mandatory standard in the intervening 18 years. It's angering that it continues to happen. There's no getting around that.
Yeah.
I remember when we started doing youth protection in 1992, the impetus for it happening in our council was the local Catholic Church, which insisted that we do it.
Well, you've told us in watching the trial in Portland, you feel like you're watching the effort of your life implode.
Sometimes.
Yeah. So tell us, have things changed?
Oh, yes, dramatically. When I was a kid, we went places and did things, and the idea of safety training of any kind was kind of like, I think there's some of that out there somewhere. We'll have to get it sometime. Now we have intense, continuous training for unit leaders, and of course we have youth protection now too.
But as you know, there's still criticism of what's going on today. Let's listen to a video that's meant for scouts. It starts off with basic rules, you know, don't go anywhere with strangers, tell an adult when someone wants you to do something that seems odd, and then it gets more serious. Let's listen.
It's your body, and you can say no. Here's the deal. Even though you're a kid, you have rights. If anybody touches you in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable, or touches your penis, or wants you to touch his, say no and get away.
Next, you're going to see what happened to Chris when the teenage daughter of the lady who ran his after-school care got him alone.
Well, see, again, that seemed pretty powerful, Mike, but then it turns attention to a very rare form of sexual abuse, a teenage babysitter. What do you think of the criticism that it's never pointed out that it could be your scoutmaster that could be the person who is inappropriate?
That's true. The counter to that is that, you know, when we first introduced that, one of the instructions that went with it was that you had to tell all the parents you were going to show their child what the organization considered relatively graphic piece of training. And I think that probably inhibited its use.
Well, and Mike, there are also online quizzes on abuse prevention for scout leaders. There's a video for them as well.
Yes, ma'am.
But do all scout leaders take it?
They're not required to yet. They will be next year.
Yeah. Well, Mike, you say membership is way down, about half, since the Supreme Court decision in 2000, which allowed scouts to screen out gay leaders and scouts. Now, we rush to say, what we're talking about now is not homosexuality, it's pedophilia. Do you think that this reward from the jury and everything that's been dredged up by the trial, do you think that's going to impact the number of scouts?
No, because Boy Scouting is an intensely local thing. Your local council are the go-to people. They are the folks at the point for everything. So if you're registered as a unit leader and you fill out the current new adult application, one of the things you have to do when you do that is sign it and agree to a background check. So if you're an entering adult, you actually have to turn in the registration form, which you say, why wouldn't anybody do that? It's very common for units, and as a matter of fact, Patrick mentions it in his book. It's very common for troops and PACs to recruit a parent, have them fill out the application, and not get around to turning in the registration for months, maybe even a year.
That's Mike Carroll. And just one thought to Patrick Boyle, again, author of Scouts Honor, Sexual Abuse in America's Most Trusted Institution. Patrick, we've been talking about the Kerry Lewis trial. He was awarded money from a jury, but his abuser also confessed to abusing 16 other boys. What do you think is going to happen here? Is this a tipping point? Are there going to be a flood of trials? And can the Boy Scouts of America withstand that?
It's impossible to say what kind of long-term effect this is going to have on the scouts. They've been sued dozens of times. This case has gotten more national attention than any other lawsuit. And certainly a victory for a victim in any of these kinds of lawsuits, including the ones against the church, the scouts, tends to embolden victims, meaning they come out. And I agree with Mike. We just don't know what's going to happen to membership or anything like that. The tipping point I would like to see is not the scouts being hurt by this because they get sued or people don't go to the scouts. I'd like to see the tipping point come at national headquarters. I'd like to see the National Boy Scouts, after this comes out, stand up and say, okay, we have a very specific sex abuse problem, and we are going to specifically look at our own cases, and we're going to learn from them, and we're going to help ourselves plus other youth-serving organizations fight this by bringing it out into the light. The problem is that's a very tough thing to do. It's going to require a lot of bravery on the part of the guys who run the Boy Scout headquarters.
That's Patrick Boyle, editor of the newspaper Youth Today, author of Scouts Honor, Sexual Abuse in America's Most Trusted Institution. And Mike is Mike Carroll, a scout volunteer in West Central Florida, lifelong member of the Scouts, who's also helped with training scout leaders in his area. Mike, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Patrick, thanks to you too.
Thank you, Robin.
And of course, we'd love to hear from you on this or any story. Just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us. You'll get information about sending emails or making phone calls. You can also scroll down right there and leave a comment. That's hereandnow.org. Don't forget, you can also always listen to us on XM Radio and follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. We'll be back after the latest news with Peter Galbraith weighing in on Afghanistan, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If a telemarketer tries to sell you something called Obamacare and it seems too good to be true, that's because it is. Since President Obama signed the new federal health insurance bill into law, scammers have gone wild. A woman in Illinois was sold protection against death panels, which of course don't exist. And Nevada is fighting back against scams using a comic public awareness campaign warning people to be on the lookout for faux salesmen like this one pitching his billboard.
You're driving along, and out of nowhere, boom, there's a billboard. Free fruitcake plus a pooch equals a health insurance plan for just $29.99.
A reenactment not far from the truth. Question the company and their plan.
Plus some tax.
Wow, free fruitcake and a pooch get you a health plan for just $29.95 a month. James Quiggle is spokesperson for the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud in Washington, D.C. Jim, Obamacare is a word that's been used derisively to describe the health care reform, but do marketers really try to sell something called that?
Oh, scammers are going door to door trying to sell what they call Obamacare health insurance. It's completely fraudulent because there is no such thing as Obamacare health insurance. They're also taking out blast faxes and sending them unsolicited to people. They're taking out cable TV ads selling stuff. They're trying to exploit confusion over what this 2,000-page health reform law really means to people. Scammers are offering limited-time benefits for full benefit coverage under the Obamacare. They're saying you have a very limited time to sign up, buy this coverage now because there's only a few slots left. You better fork over your credit card now while you still can. That scares a lot of people.
Sure. In Alabama, a con artist is offering government health care reform and asking for people's bank account numbers and then taking the payments for this health care reform, which you can't buy. It's a bill. Taking the payments directly out of their bank accounts.
Yes, and they're also targeting seniors. They're trying to offer fake prescription rebates and saying they're here to help facilitate prescription rebates under Medicare Plan D, which does not use middlemen to try to make this happen.
Well, this is just the latest in health insurance scams. You've been on this for a couple of years. You say you've seen the increase because of the health care debate. But what should consumers do? How do you protect yourself against it?
Well, scammers have been plying the markets for at least 2 years. They're exploiting people's confusion and desperation over affordable health care, and a lot of people are falling victim to these scams. You need to ask yourself, is this deal too good to be true? Premiums are rising, yet scammers are often offering deals with extraordinarily low premiums, easy sign-up, regardless of pre-existing conditions, and they're not even requiring a whole lot of paperwork or medical exams. That just doesn't happen in this day. You need to watch out if they're offering something that good and that easy.
There were faxes in Nevada offering bogus health coverage for as little as $29.95 a month. That's not going to happen.
No, you're not going to get coverage that cheaply. But sometimes the deals are actually priced affordably as a subterfuge to make people think, well, maybe the coverage is real. What you need to do is call your state insurance department to see if the plan is licensed in your state. One phone call can save you a world of hurt.
A woman in Alabama was offered one of the last 20 spots on a government health insurance plan. If you're asked to join something, is that a clue that something's wrong?
Well, if you have to join a pool right now, if they're offering you a limited-time deal with only a few slots left, don't believe it for a minute. That's ridiculous because the mechanisms haven't been set up, and we don't know exactly what the requirements are going to be yet. You can check by calling your state insurance department. Ask the insurance department, is the company and is the plan itself licensed to do business in your state?
Kathleen Sebelius, Health and Human Services Secretary, disclosed this month that she'd sent letters to state insurance regulators and prosecutors telling them to be on the lookout for these scam artists. As we said, Nevada has launched a very creative public awareness campaign. It features the health insurance company Swindle, Fraud, and Ripoff, which sounds like Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. So Nevada's obviously trying to tell people what to look for. What are other states doing?
Well, states right now are urgently sending out consumer alerts, trying to let people know that these scams are happening. The first thing people are trying to do is make sure the public knows that these are scams, that the Obama Health Care Reform Initiative has not sent out literature or marketing literature and is not sending out door-to-door salespeople trying to pitch health insurance unannounced to vulnerable consumers.
James Quiggle is spokesperson for the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud on a wave of Obamacare scams. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Robin.
Okay, just ahead. Does the U.S. have a credible partner in Afghanistan? We're going to speak to former diplomat Peter Galbraith. And why is everyone mad at him here and now? Welcome back. Where are we on Afghanistan? There's been an upsurge in violence. Today, two Afghans were killed, two police officers injured by a series of explosions in the southern city of Kandahar. Small teams of U.S. Special Forces are reportedly in that area in advance of this summer's planned operation to rout the Taliban. Meanwhile, Afghan President Hamid Karzai will meet with President Obama in Washington next month, after which Karzai is calling for a huge meeting of almost 1,500 tribal and ethnic Afghans, a peace jirga, to reach some kind of consensus on what to do about insurgents. Peter Galbraith is a former U.N. diplomat in Afghanistan. We want to get a snapshot of that country from him today. Peter, welcome.
Very good to be with you.
And first I want to start, you know, you have a complicated relationship with Afghanistan, to say the least. So let's just, a couple questions there, because you were fired from the U.N. last summer. You felt election fraud was being covered up. You were also accused of planning to force Hamid Karzai to resign. You've said that was just an off-the-record sort of exploration of possibilities to resolve a crisis. And you've now, in fact, filed legal action against the U.N. for dismissal on false grounds. But there seems to be more overarching thought here is, what is it that you are saying that has everyone so mad at you?
Well, first, just to be completely clear about the issue of whether I was plotting to overthrow Karzai, and I have to say I thought the story was that appeared in the New York Times about it was very manipulative. It omitted some pretty key facts, like the fact that I had filed a case against the UN, and when the defendant in an action puts out a story to smear the plaintiff, you ought to be suspicious, and readers ought to know that.
You're saying that the Times quoted the same person you're suing for firing you as saying that you were hatching a plan to...
Well, exactly. And it didn't even disclose. It just said, according to two UN officials, it wasn't until the 10th paragraph you could figure out it was the guy who actually had...
Right.
Manipulated my dismissal. But the facts, I think it's important for people to understand. Karzai's term ended on the 21st of May, 2009. He was maneuvering to stay in office unconstitutionally for a full year beyond the end of his term with no election. And so my concern was, how do we address that constitutional crisis? So far from proposing his removal, I was in fact concerned about what the political consequences would be if he was kept in office without an election, because this was going to divide the country.
Well, but Karzai is in office. And as we said, the White House seems to have resolved its differences with President Karzai. He's coming next month to talk to President Obama. So where do you think we should go from here? Let's start with corruption in Afghanistan, the U.S. pouring money in. The New York Times editorializes that the country should hand over responsibility for overseeing the Afghan economy to a third party like the World Bank. Your thoughts on, start with corruption.
Well, look, the biggest form of corruption is one that neither the United Nations nor the Obama administration seems to want to recognize, which is, of course, stealing an election. And this wasn't, you know, a few stuffed ballot boxes. This was at least a million, possibly as many as 1.5 million phony votes, not stuffed ballot boxes, but results recorded from places where nobody actually voted.
And, of course, President Karzai said it was the UN that was perpetrating the fraud.
Well, oddly, he denied that there had been any fraud for months. And then on the 1st of April, he came out and said, yes, there was widespread fraud, basically admitting that he had not honestly been reelected. But he said Afghans didn't do it. The UN did it. Galbraith did it.
So what do we do with that? I mean, obviously, it's been decided that it would just be too messy to make the change.
Well, the Obama administration at the beginning of the month actually came out, and they were pretty tough. They were very tough on Karzai. The president's press spokesman said he's not an ally. And I actually think he is an ally. He's just a very undesirable ally. But then after this exchange with Karzai, Karzai saying he might even join the Taliban, mm-hmm. I think public support for the war dropped 10 or 15 points in this country. And the administration realized that having a fight with Karzai was going to undermine support for the war. And so they've had to make up because they don't see any alternative.
Right. How could you send troops to defend a country that's led by a fraudulent leader?
Well, that's exactly the dilemma. And there's a moral dilemma. Is this what our troops are fighting for? But there's actually a strategic dilemma. We are embarked on a counterinsurgency strategy. And in order for a counterinsurgency strategy to work, you have to have a local partner, a credible local partner.
And I'm just going to jump in to say, because this is counterintuitive for some people, listeners we've heard from, counterinsurgency means defeating the insurgents by winning over the populace.
As the generals would say, the center of gravity in the country is the people. And what does that mean practically? It means when our troops go into an area, they clear out the Taliban. Frankly, they don't kill very many of them because these people simply go home. They don't take off their uniforms because they're not wearing any. But then you need to have an Afghan army that can come in and provide security. You need an Afghan police that can come in and provide law and order. And most important, you need an Afghan government that can come in, provide honest administration, and win the loyalty of the population. Otherwise, you're just going to have your troops there holding it forever. And none of those elements are in place.
Well, in fact, the last operation against the Taliban 2 months ago was in Marja. It did clear the Taliban from the area, but Afghan officials are saying today the Taliban is making a comeback there. We have the UN asking 200 employees to stay home today because of the security situation we just mentioned in Kandahar. And we remember that UN guest house that was attacked by insurgents. We read over the weekend that the UN employee, an American, who was the security guard who fought off these insurgents, allowed people to escape. After it was over, he was shot and killed by Afghan police.
He was executed in cold blood. The UN has known that for months. It has not raised the issue with the Afghan government. It has not conducted an investigation. It's done nothing about it.
Peter Galbraith, every time we speak to you about Afghanistan, it's very depressing. It doesn't feel as if there's endgame. I mean, are you saying that if there is an Afghan army first, there will be success? What are you saying?
I'm actually saying that I see no prospect of getting what we need for our strategy to work, which is a credible local partner. And if that's the case, we shouldn't be committing 100,000 troops to this mission. We ought to look at what it is that we might possibly accomplish. There are some things we can do. One is that we can keep the Taliban out of the north, where they mostly are not. We can protect Kabul, which is now a city of 5 million and is relatively peaceful. And we could focus on counterterrorism, meaning that where we get intelligence that the Taliban are located or where al-Qaeda is located, we can strike at them. And that mission can be accomplished with many fewer troops, maybe 20,000. And then we save lives, we save money, and we have our troops available for other more achievable and, frankly, I think more important national security missions.
Peter Galbraith, former UN diplomat in Afghanistan. Peter, thanks so much as always.
Very good being with you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the Goldman Sachs Senate hearings. Also, how do you get to Radio City Music Hall? You dance, dance, dance. A Rockettes audition. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Balkan Beatbox, Here and Now. Welcome back. Take folk and klezmer music, give it some hip-hop and techno beats, add a heaping dose of political awareness, and you've got the Balkan Beatbox.
I try to figure out, but I don't understand what makes one man better than another man. I try to figure out if there's something I can do to change the way you see me and I see you.
That's the title song from their new CD, Blue-Eyed Black Boy, which is being released this week. At Balkan Beatbox's core is the Israeli-born trio of Ori Kaplan, Tamir Muscat, and Tomer Yosef, who met in and were shaped by the New York music scene. As Entertainment Weekly says, they make music that both Booby and the grandkids can groove to. Joining us, one of Balkan Beatbox's co-founders, Ori Kaplan. Ori, just about this song first, Blue-Eyed Black Boy. We were listening to one of the phrases, "When you look at my skin, you see black." Tell us more about those lyrics.
Tomer Yosef sings and wrote these lyrics. Tomer is of Yemenite heritage. He's black. When he's in America, he's, I think he feels black and treated as such. And as well as Israel, which, you know, unfortunately in this world, people notice the color of your skin and judge you. And Tomer wrote this song about many different things. But I think mostly about the possibility of bridging bigotry.
If you look into my eyes, you'll see the color blue. If I look at you, I'll see a human who is living in this town like I live every day. Trying to survive, trying to find his way. If you're looking at my skin, you'll see the color black. We better look ahead.
What was the goal initially when you first formed the group? What is it you wanted to say? Because it's a distinct style. So how'd you get to it?
There was an emerging kind of immigrant vibe in New York around 2001. I was playing with Gogol Bordello and touring.
Oh, sure.
Tamir was producing a couple of the things that we did. There was a moment there where, you know, everyone was searching for something they can say in New York, which include immigrants who are celebrating their own heritage. We were there, and when you look for yourself in New York and want to be best at what you do, you have to look back to realize who we are, where we came from musically, and to dig in to translate this to the instruments and also the modern capability to interpret it in an electronic kind of setup. When we first started, it was the first song was with Bulgarian singers. It was called Bulgarian Chicks, and it was quite the mix of the computer and definitely a Balkan traditional sound.
You seem to have moved around the world pretty comfortably, but we've talked to other musicians who have done that. Borders don't mean as much to you.
No, I really don't really care about them. In fact, I don't like them. None of us do. We travel all the time and we meet people and we feel how artificial borders are. Last album was a year-long process where we recorded in Belgrade, for example, for 4 days with gypsy musicians from a village in South Serbia. And we spent time on a hill in a television studio in Belgrade. Had amazing musicians come to the studio with vans, with their trumpets and tubas. And that's how we recorded a lot of the songs in the album.
Place us in time, because, you know, news continued.
This was last year when we made the new album.
What was going on there at the time?
It was actually riots in Serbia, in Belgrade, about the Kosovo independence, and they were burning the American embassy's window at the time. There were millions of cops and quite a big turmoil. And at the same time, we were on the hill making beautiful music, contrasting all that energy.
How did that energy make it into one of the songs? I'm thinking of the track War Again. Did some of what was happening outside the studio infuse the music?
I think so. Although War Again was written for another project that Jessica, our friend, did, filming a workshop in the desert. What if Palestinians and Iranians and Israelis meet in the desert, musicians trying to make an album together? Just impromptu album, and this the song War Again was written for that.
Huh, let's listen.
Here we are, like we're gonna get war again. Coming hard, coming get a gun, join the gang. With the bang bang and the same song we sang. Coming over and over again. Picking up now, getting more like
Ori Kaplan. You know, we hear of musicians trying to do this, trying to reach across these, you know, boundaries. And then what?
This is a default condition for us since we're born in Israel and still would like to see this home of ours flourish. The only way for it to flourish is to share it with the other people who live there. All the people who have the same right to be there, you know, and it's a global feeling. It talks about many people in everywhere around the world where there's conflict. The only way to do it is look at each other in the eye and see and really, really try to zoom out and realize what does the other feel and how can we communicate.
We took a decision to have no definition, and our ammunition is to keep our love true. We chose to share a vision more than we envisioned. While this song is playing, I wanna dance with you.
What do your parents tell you? What do people that you know in Israel say to you? Do they think that that's a utopian vision, you know, that's good for a song but too dangerous in reality?
I don't know. I feel like the left camp in Israel is hugely proud of us. And it's quite a large camp, as a, you know, even though it's a hidden, you don't hear it much as you couldn't hear maybe the democratic camp in the Bush days. You say, where are these people? Where is their voice? It's a huge voice and it took over now. And that's what we hope will happen in Israel as well, that sanity will prevail and come back. So that's what we feel. A lot of support from a lot of Israelis who believe that this is the way to do it, this is the way to go, and they know it inside.
That's Ori Kaplan, co-founder of the group Balkan Beatbox. By the way, Balkan, does that refer to the Balkans, or does it refer to how you have, you know, you're made up of so many different sounds, Balkanized?
Yeah, it represents the kind of folky part of us. Tamir's mother is Romanian. There is a connection in our heritage to the Balkans. But you might as well call us a Mediterranean beatbox, because we are very, very much connected to that whole Mediterranean through the Balkans. The meeting of klezmer and Balkans and Sephardic music, Moroccan music, all around the Mediterranean pond, to the electronic music, to new music, to modern urban club music.
Okay, again, that's Ori Kaplan, one of the co-founders of the group Balkan Beatbox. Their new CD is Blue Eyed Black Boy. Ori Kaplan, thanks.
Thanks very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service, MPRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.